This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from Minnesota Public Radio in the Twin Cities. We're here for some meetings. We'll be spending time with folks. Thanks so much for listening. I'm also going to be getting an earful later today for my parents who live in the area, my lovely aging parents. My mom actually spent a few days in one of the fine hospitals here in the area. She's totally fine, but she will no doubt be back to correcting my grammar a little later today. I'm looking forward to that. We're going to begin this week, though, with the revelation that a software whiz has proclaimed himself a hero, quit the CIA and the NSA, gone to Hong Kong after disclosing the U.S. surveillance of internet and cell phone communications by the National Security Administration, the NSA. Edward Snowden says he is saving the United States from itself, saving the world from the United States. Here he is in his own words.
Even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call. And then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
Mr. Snowden is a former technical assistant, a subcontractor for the NSA-CIA programs. He conducted this 12-minute video interview with The Guardian, the news organization that broke the surveillance story last week. Snowden was employed by, we don't know his employment status after all this, though, Booz Allen Hamilton, a consulting firm and defense contractor which sells technology and manpower to mostly the NSA and other federal agencies. Snowden is 29 years old. He maintains that he had a duty to relay all this information to the public. He calls himself a whistleblower, but the federal government is probably more likely to call him an accused felon, a traitor, and an international fugitive.
You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you. And if living unfreely but comfortably is something you're willing to accept, and I think many of us are, it's the human nature. If you realize that that's the world that you helped create, and it's going to get worse with the next generation and the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression, you realize that you might be willing to accept any risk.
The apocalyptic thoughts there of Edward Snowden, who is a whistleblower in this surveillance case. Evan Osnos joins us now, China correspondent for The New Yorker. He's in Beijing, China. We mentioned Mr. Snowden is in Hong Kong. Evan, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
What do you make of the fact that Snowden is in Hong Kong? Why would you go there? Would Hong Kong actually be a place of refuge for someone like this?
Well, I got to tell you, it is a very unusual situation. Most of the time when those of us who live and work in this part of the world are dealing with cases of, in effect, a defector, usually it's people going in the other direction. Hong Kong is, let's remember, it's a special autonomous region of the People's Republic of China, which means basically that it has control over its own internal affairs. And then the Beijing government is responsible for things like foreign affairs, national security, and intelligence. So Hong Kong has an extradition treaty with the United States. It's been in place for 15 years, and every year they do send people abroad from Hong Kong who have been requested by law enforcement agencies to be sent back to their home country. So there's a precedent for people leaving. So in some ways, he has chosen a fairly risky place to go.
And we must presume that Edward Snowden understands that the kinds of things he did to the U.S. government would be perceived as equally a threat to the Chinese government, which has, you know, no tolerance for messing around on the internet and disclosing state secrets.
Yeah, he says that he's gone to Hong Kong because of what I think he rightly describes as the city's commitment to free speech and the right of political dissent. The challenge, of course, the hard thing now is that the Chinese government can choose the role it wants to play in this case. I mean, you know, if it does nothing, then presumably he'll be subject to an ordinary extradition process, which can actually take several months or longer, in fact, if his lawyers put up resistance. But if Beijing decides to step in and say, we consider this an issue of national security, we also, frankly, don't want to screw up the relationship with the United States. That, you know, President Xi Jinping in Beijing just finished a very intense summit with Obama over the last few days, in which one of the major topics was cybersecurity. And they're trying to come up with a new arrangement in which both sides feel that they're being listened to and that their interests are being honored. So if Beijing intervenes, in a sense, to shelter Edward Snowden, what they're signaling to the Obama administration is an affirmative gesture, in effect, to try to reject an American government effort to recover one of its own citizens who it considers to have violated the law. So that's the challenge that Edward Snowden's facing. He's not just facing an ordinary extradition law with the United States. He's also confronting the fact that the Chinese government may have a diplomatic incentive to want to cooperate with the United States.
We're talking with Evan Osnos, China correspondent for The New Yorker. You know, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers a generation ago, described Snowden as a hero, described the United States as the United Stasi, referring to the East German surveillance during the Cold War. He also described Snowden as something of a hero. Is that a widely held view in China or Hong Kong?
I think people over here, frankly, are a little baffled by this case. I mean, even with a lot of the sentiment in China these days, which can be sometimes kind of suspicious of the United States, people still basically think of America as a country that has a very firm rule of law. They think of it as the place that their dissidents go for refuge. So the idea of the tables being turned is still hard for people to process. I mean, it's one of the interesting things that jumps out at me is that when you look at the way that Edward Snowden talks about China and talks about Hong Kong, really, because he is talking about Hong Kong, which occupies this slightly different status. One of the things he says is that I don't want to live in a country in which the government can readily have access to your phone, to your email, to your passwords, your phone records. And when I read that, I thought, actually, the truth is that is exactly the way it is here in the mainland, here in China. I mean, you live with the reasonable expectation that the government has full access to your electronic communications at all times. And in fact, not just the government. I mean, there are corporate investigators who have the ability, as one of them told me over lunch not long ago, very casually, he said, if you want, I can get you a record of every text message you've sent over the last 8 years. So I don't think that China is necessarily a natural place to go for defending digital privacy.
How convenient living there in China. Evan Osnos, China correspondent for The New Yorker, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We'll have more on the Edward Snowden case a little later this hour. A discussion now of the scale of the conflict in Syria. We'll begin with thoughts about the humanitarian disaster unfolding there and conclude later this hour with an assessment of whether Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and the Gulf states are headed for a broader and possibly millennial sectarian conflict between Sunni Muslims and the Shiites among them. But first, the United Nations says that half of Syria's population may be needing humanitarian aid by the end of this year, 10 million people. It'll cost as much as $5 billion. And what security challenges does the crumbling of a nation of 20 million people pose for the international community? And will the U.S. be forced to pay all or most of that bill eventually? Joining us now by Skype in Damascus is Lise Doucette, chief international correspondent for the BBC. Welcome, Lise.
Welcome. Good to talk to you, John.
How much news is it, the scale of this humanitarian disaster that the United Nations is now talking about?
Well, let's just look at one place, which is a microcosm of a wider war, and that is the destroyed city of Qusair that government forces took back last week, helped by Lebanese Hezbollah fighters after 3 weeks of very, very heavy fighting. We made two visits to that city, and it's that horrible truth of war that even when you win, you lose, because the government scored an important strategic victory, but Qusair is gone. It's a dead city now. There was no people, no civilians, the day that we visited it in the first hours after battle. There was not a single house that had been left untouched by any of the weapons that had been thrown at each other. The second day we went back, we saw a few families coming back. Now, the reports we're getting today is that a few more are bravely trying to return to their homes, because some have been out of their homes since a year ago when the rebels took over the city. Now that some of them are coming back today. Some of those who left more recently are trying to come back. But the big question is where are all the people? This used to be, before the war, a thriving, bustling border city of 30,000 people. Someone from the United Nations said to me, 5,000 people fled. We don't know where they are. The ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, says we know that hundreds were trapped inside there wounded. We haven't been able to get access to Qusair, and we've only been able to treat 87 people. So switch that Qusair for Aleppo, for Deir ez-Zor, for Idlib. It is the same across the country. There are areas like Damascus relatively peaceful, but even here the sound of shelling goes on night and day. There's not a bit of Syria that isn't in some way damaged, destroyed, or affected in some way by this war.
In Damascus, Syria, Lise Doucette is chief international correspondent for the BBC. You've been there many, many times, and under circumstances where it appeared the government was resisting coverage of what's going on the ground. Has that changed? Does the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad want the international community to know the scale of the destruction?
Well, we need permission for anywhere we go. They say it's for our protection. They may have a point in that, because often the places we want to go are the places that we can see with our own eyes are coming under fire. We can hear the sounds of shelling. We can talk to people who've been forced to flee their neighborhoods, and they often say to us, no, it's still not safe. Sometimes we still manage to get in. Sometimes we manage to go in by contacting members of the opposition who, you know, there's always a way to get around things. But I think, you know, we have this maxim in our job, John, and that is the truth will eventually emerge. And the truth does eventually emerge, not just because people like me manage to get visas, manage to get to those places, but because there are a whole lot of people out there who are taking pictures on their mobile telephones, uploading them to YouTube or to other servers and, you know, go on the internet. Nobody anywhere in the world can say they don't know what's happening in Syria.
Any sign that this could resolve itself as a partition of Syria at this point before we go?
Oh, you asked very calmly a very explosive question. That is one of the dangerous scenarios for Syria as more and more commanders for the opposition take up the fight. It is a very splintered, a very fractured opposition. There's fiefdoms right across the country now. It is a misnomer, a dangerous misnomer to talk about government versus the opposition. Add an S to the word on opposition. Government does have hold of some areas, largely the centers of major urban areas. And the general impression is what we see on the ground and what we hear is that after their victory at Qusair, they're pressing on. They're going to try to push back the rebels in Homs, the nearest biggest city. They're going to try to push back in Aleppo as well, helped, of course, by the well-trained Hezbollah fighters. And there are, of course, foreign fighters on the side of the opposition as well. This is not just Syria's war. It's everyone's war.
An extraordinary view on the ground in Syria from Lise Doucette, chief international correspondent for the BBC. Thanks, Lise.
Thank you, John.
More on the sectarian nature of the Syrian conflict from an attorney who just returned from the war-torn region. That's next on The Takeaway. Last week, in our discussion of whether the war in Syria is becoming a regional conflict, we heard this from Genev Abdo, a fellow with the Middle East Southwest Asia program at the Washington, D.C.-based Stimson Center.
Syria began as just sort of a protest movement against Assad, but now there's a great and very important religious doctrinal dimension to the Shia-Sunni conflict.
From a protest against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to something much bigger. Well, there have been many moments in 20th century history and in our century when observers have suggested that conflicts between nations are just proxies for the mother of all battles in the Middle East, if there ever should be an all-out war between Muslims, Sunni versus Shiites. Alia Malik is a journalist and civil rights lawyer and the author of A Country Called Amrika, U.S. History Retold Through Arab American Lives. Alia, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you've spent plenty of time in Syria recently. What is your assessment of this sectarian dimension of the Syrian story? It's certainly there, but how apocalyptic should we be thinking in these terms?
I think it's important to note that sectarianism has become, as I said in the article, has become the vehicle of the conflict, but it was never its impulse. And the reason it's important to identify this is because if we really want to start thinking about solutions for how we can bring stability back to Syria and stop the killing, we need to sort of understand, you know, or be able to distinguish between what caused the conflict and what sustains the conflict.
does the idea of rivalry between Sunni and Shia Muslims sustain the conflict, or is it some deeper set of forces that could explode, be ignited by this conflict?
I think we need to sort of take apart what sectarianism is. I heard the woman before said it was a religious doctrinal sort of conflict. You know, this isn't necessarily, I mean, there's religiosity and then there's sectarianism. And there can be people who are sectarian without being religious at all. And there are people who can be religious without being, not being sectarian, without being sectarian, they're actually quite secular. There are secular folks who are not sectarian and there are secular folks who are indeed sectarian. So we sort of have to take that apart. This isn't necessarily a doctrinal conflict, but this is a situation where citizenship in Syria is somewhat meaningless, okay? So if you begin to have these existentialist fears that if I don't have a state that protects and guarantees my rights, then I need to look to a protector outside. Similarly, these would-be protectors from outside use the sort of shared religion to be able to impose themselves on the affairs of another country. And that's what you see happening from many angles, whether it's Iran trying to play the patron of the Shiites in the Arab world, or the Gulf countries trying to play the patron of the Sunni Arabs within the Arab world. And I think it's just, you know, we've been sort of talking about sectarianism and doctrinal and proxy wars as shortcuts. And I think we need to sort of unpack that if we're really invested in coming up with a way to end the conflict.
Now, there certainly are arguments over whether, Shia Islam and its, observations about who is a successor to the Prophet Muhammad. Those arguments go on. But what really drives these conflicts is the fact that these religious groups are in positions of political authority over one another in mm-hmm. places like Bahrain or Iraq. And now, in this case, Syria. How does the political authority get mixed up mm-hmm. with the doctrine?
Well, you know, in the case of Syria, the regime had a sectarian face. I mean, everybody sort of shortcut says that this is a Alawi minority oppressing a Sunni majority. But we have to also unpack that, because basically what happened in Syria, and I think, you know, I don't know why we have this tendency to want to sort of make everything more foreign to us. But basically, this is a class struggle. You have the effects of climate change, a massive drought that sort of pushed rural people into the peripheries of the cities. So who benefited from the regime? Yes, there were this small circle of Alawites that are affiliated with the Assad family. But the greater beneficiaries were sort of, you know, economic elites who, like the majority of the country, happened to be Sunni. And these are economic elites that lived in the cities. So the conflict, you know, if we insist on viewing exclusively through a sectarian lens, we're not going to really understand what's going on. And, you know, I just want to go back to the idea of, Shia Islam. And, you know, I'm not a religious scholar. I'm not going to get into that discussion. But again, this isn't necessarily about religion, yes, there's some people who are going to get, you know, fundamentalist about, you know, particulars of the theology. But this is really about, if I am identified by my sect and I am not going to be protected in this chaos, or I need somebody to protect me, that's where religion becomes, relevant. And it's that looking at who can be your protector, and who is, like, Iran has constructed itself as a Shiite state. You know, if it had constructed itself as a Persian state, then maybe, you know, it would be protecting Persian-speaking peoples in other parts of the world. But because it's, you know, chosen this as its sort of central characteristic, it gives it power within countries where there are Shiite populations that aren't in Iran.
Finally, I mean, it's mostly absurd in the Christian world to think of wars between Protestants and Catholics. But where that is not ridiculous, of course, is in Northern Ireland, where there are political dimensions to Catholics and Protestants exactly. having dominion over each other. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, there is a kind of mirroring. It only really is relevant when people decide to make political decisions based on religion.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And, you know, more relevant is that if you live in a state where everyone's citizenship rights are not equal and not protected, you're going to look for something else or someone else to sort of protect those rights. And in a situation where in Syria, where it's almost become existentialist, like, you know, survival depends on finding an outside patron. Yes, that's what that's exactly what you're seeing happening. And, you know, hard to imagine, not if we study history, if we know European history, we know about the wars between Protestants and Catholics, that's not, you know, it's not actually that foreign to us.
Alia Malik is a journalist and civil rights lawyer and author of a country called Amrika, U.S. history retold through Arab American lives. She spent a lot of time in Syria over the last 18 months. Alia Malik, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from the Twin Cities of Minnesota. It's going to come down to a debate over security versus equity for illegal immigrants in the U.S. That's in Washington, D.C., where the Senate begins debate this week on a compromise immigration reform bill that is not a done deal, despite the optimism from Majority Leader Harry Reid.
I am totally convinced that there is tremendous momentum to get this legislation passed.
But of course, as we know, momentum has a way of becoming molasses in this Congress. With us is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So how big of a moment is this here, and what is the likelihood that it will dissipate the momentum that Harry Reid is talking about?
Well, immigration summer has begun. It begins tomorrow with the first cloture vote to get the bill on the Senate floor, and then Harry Reid is going to spend the rest of June, John, up until the July 4th break, trying to pass this comprehensive immigration reform bill, this Gang of Eight proposal, which now is sort of a Gang of Nine proposal, we'll get to that, by the July 4th recess. Now, Harry Reid has a lot of optimism, but here's the thing. It's not really about Harry Reid at this point. It is to some extent, but it's really about another senator, Marco Rubio. We've talked about him, from Florida, the Tea Party favorite, the son of Cubans, and the senator whose job is to make this bill palatable to conservatives, and it's been tough. John, over the weekend and before the weekend, Marco Rubio kind of dropped a bomb on this process. He's a member of that bipartisan Gang of Eight. He helped write this bill, and now he's going around the television shows over the weekend and a little bit before the weekend saying, guess what? It can't pass, and I can't vote for it unless there are more border security measures that are already in the bill. We need them tougher than they are. And that's Rubio saying that conservatives, Republicans on the right, need border security tougher than what I already agreed to, or else this thing won't even get 60. Forget about 70.
Are the Republicans going to make a showdown out of this immigration issue, given the numbers that were so negative as far as Latino voters are concerned in the 2012 election?
And that's the real question that's knocking around Capitol Hill. The Senate is the easier lift on this. Will Republicans make a show of this and really kill a bill that all of the political experts say they need to help pass if they want to have any truck with Latinos for the next 10 years? In the Senate, the answer is probably no. It looks like, because Rubio's not alone, and there are other Republicans like Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who said over the weekend that she's going to back this proposal as is. So it seems like there may be enough Republicans to get to magical 60. But John, they don't have an agreement on the House side yet. They don't even have an agreement over a comprehensive proposal yet. Speaker John Boehner, this Senate bill is supposed to pass by July 4th if they can get it passed. He wants to spend between July 4th and the end of the summer trying to get a House bill passed. And House conservatives so far don't have any interest really in a comprehensive reform bill. They say, we want to pass smaller, bite-sized pieces, smaller things that certainly include more border security. What are conservative Republicans in the House willing to do on a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants? It's not clear that they're willing to do much. And in their Gang of Eight on the House side, they just lost one. They just lost their conservative Tea Party member, Congressman Raul Labrador from Idaho. He's out. So the easy lift seems to be here in June, getting to July 4th. The tougher lift from July 4th to the end of August in the House. But John, you're right. Speaker John Boehner knows that he's in the same boat as everybody else. His party really wants to be able to pass something. The question is, can they merge that pragmatism with the Tea Party, with the conservatives who aren't terribly interested in this? Last note, John, Karl Rove's trying to help him out. Crossroads GPS is putting $100,000 on the table in ads to try to pass this bill. Jeb Bush has signed on, along with a whole bunch of others.
Rove was so helpful in the 2012 election. I'm sure they'll love that.
He's got money.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and they're out there waiting to be born. The summer bug blockbuster, the cicada swarmageddon, has been less than advertised. Have you noticed? In New York City, Staten Island has seen the Hellstrom Chronicle-looking creatures, but they've been quiet in most other places in the city. Dr. Gene Kritzky is the chair of biology at the College of Mount St. Joseph in Cincinnati. He's the editor of American Entomologist. Dr. Kritzky joins me now. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Have the cicadas been a little deceptive with us? Is this about climate change, or is it about something we fundamentally don't know about the habits of this insect?
Well, it's mostly related to the known distribution of the insect. The cicadas were quite numerous back in the 1860s when they emerged in Bronx County, 1877 again, 1894. In Central Park in 1894, they emerged. But what we're actually seeing is probably the effects of land use, habitat destruction a little bit. Cicadas do not emerge from under roads, for example, or cleared fields. And so we're seeing the effect of a century of development as well.
And are we seeing the effect of 17 years of development in the sense that that's the cycle that we're looking at, right?
Yes, we're seeing the cicadas that who developed from eggs that were laid 17 years ago. And of course, if there were no cicadas in these various areas 17 years ago, there'd be no cicadas today. And they can disperse upwards to about a mile. But if you go to an area, let's say, and clear cut the trees out and put in a housing development, put in the infrastructure, and then replant trees, unless you're within a mile of another cicada population, you won't have cicadas in 17 years.
And so it's the tranquil neighborhoods that haven't experienced a lot of development that are going to hear these buzzing sounds that I actually remember from my youth. And it's quite nostalgic to hear them in a recording. But they're pretty much absent from my life these days.
Well, it's true. You need to go to someplace like Staten Island, as you mentioned. Indeed, if you look at a map of where they're emerging in the greater New York area, for example, New York City looks almost like the an open center in the surrounding and parts of Newark and Staten Island, and even up in the little few reports in the northern part of the Bronx. It looks like they missed the city.
What is the geographic distribution of cicadas if we're looking globally or just around North America?
Well, we're talking primarily now about the periodical cicadas, and the periodical cicada is unique to the eastern half of the United States. There are about 2,500 species of cicadas globally, but these 17-year cicadas that we're talking about are as unique to the United States as giraffes are to Africa.
And when a cicada comes out of its pupa or whatever we
nymphal
call it,
skin.
Yeah,
the
what
last,
is it? What?
The last nymphal skin.
The last nymphal skin.
Correct.
After 17 years, what is that cicada hungry for more than anything?
Well, it's it eats very little as an adult. It's actually hungry for sex.
I understand that, yes.
They are out basically for a short stint in the sun. The males will sing to attract a mate. The female will lay her eggs in the new growth of trees. And then within a few days, they're gone. They're dead. This whole emergence will last, in most cases, about 4 to 6 weeks in a given location.
And is this a moment for entomologists to really study and answer questions that we don't really understand about this insect?
Oh, definitely. In fact, it's not where they're expected that's sometimes exciting. It's where they come out where they're not expected. For example, we had a small emergence here in Cincinnati this year, which is way off cycle, 8 years from when we expected them. And so understanding why they get their calendars wrong is going to be critical in understanding how the different broods of cicadas evolve.
Of course, it may not be that they got it wrong. It could be we got it wrong, and they know something about the environment that we don't, so they're coming out early.
That's true. We do know that warmer temperatures are triggering a possible spurt in their underground development, which is making them come out 4 years early.
Dr. Gene Kritzky is chair of biology at College of Mount St. Joseph and editor of American Entomologist, talking about the cicadas. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you.
It's not exactly government surveillance, but our co-producer WNYC is tracking cicadas all the way up the East Coast from Georgia to Connecticut. You can head over to project.wnyc.org/cicadas to find out more and to see all the cicadas.
And the locust sang off in the distance, yeah.
It will be an arduous process, but sometime this week, after the vetting of as many as 500 jurors, the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman trial will have a panel of 6 citizens from the area around Sanford, Florida, to serve as a jury for one of the most celebrated trials in Florida history. Trayvon Martin, killed by self-styled neighborhood enforcer George Zimmerman back in February of 2012, caught the attention of the world when it seemed as though the police and law enforcement simply accepted the story that Zimmerman acted in self-defense and that young Trayvon Martin was a threat. Now Zimmerman faces charges of second-degree murder. A special prosecutor is handling the case. And at the very least, this trial will be a chance for the law enforcement and court system in Sanford, Florida, to redeem itself to the world. Joining us now is reporter Audra Birch of the Miami Herald. We will speak in a moment with community member Pastor Valerie Houston from the Allen Chapel Church in Sanford, Florida. Reporter Audrey Birch, how do things stand? What do we expect to see over the next few days and weeks?
I think what you're going to see is a tremendously emotional scene. Of course, the justice system is going to take place, but you're also going to see a number of really, really passionate people who will be probably attending. The city has set up three safety zones, and those are places where people can have free speech. So you'll see people there who may feel very, very strongly on the Trayvon Martin side, and also people on the George Zimmerman side. And those people are allowed to be outside, and they're allowed to express themselves as long as they do it in a very civilized sort of way. Inside, you're going to see the prosecutors and the defense try to seat a jury for six people as well as four alternates. And the key for them is going to be able to find not people who haven't heard of the case, but people who believe that they can go into it and be unbiased.
I don't know how much, you know, you alluded there that the community of Sanford has sides, and there's a Trayvon Martin side and a Zimmerman side on some level. Does anyone in this community want to be a juror in this case? Is there enthusiasm about this job or fear?
I don't know that there would be enthusiasm, particularly for a second-degree murder case, but also for a case that this community has had to live with for so long. They'll be picking people out of this Seminole County area, so it'll be an area that's a little bit larger than the city itself. But you're talking about a city that has been faced with a case that has haunted them in some ways, that happened in their community, and they have been trying to heal ever since with the help of the Justice Department, as well as the sheriffs, as well as the city, who have been holding all sorts of events that have hopefully helped people to have open dialogue and talk about what happened.
Well, certainly this trial will be a part of the changes in Sanford, Florida on the issue of race on the community level. But I'm wondering if it's also a trial of the Stand Your Ground laws. Will anything there change, or is this just about Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman?
Well, I think that there's a number of things that are on trial here, if you will, even if it's in a figurative sense. I don't think that there's any way that this trial can go on and not escape dealing with what we know is a controversial self-defense law. And so regardless of the verdict, I think that the legislators are going to be forced to take a very hard look at that law and see if it's applicable.
How controversial will it be for members of the community to hear indictments on some level, criticisms of Trayvon Martin himself, his behavior, his approach, his look, the kinds of things that George Zimmerman will rely on in his defense?
Well, what we found during the pretrial hearing is that many of the things that we found out that were released leading up to the court case itself will not actually be allowed unless you have witnesses on the state side that open the door and allow those things in. And so, you know, what we know in public is not necessarily what is going to be considered inside the courtroom.
All right. Audra Birch of the Miami Herald covering the George Zimmerman trial in Sanford, Florida, pulling jurors from the entire Seminole County area there near Orlando. Audra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we're joined by Pastor Valerie Houston there in the community from the Allen Chapel Church in Sanford, Florida. Reverend Houston, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, so many people are being looked at, vetted. They'll be filling out questionnaires today. Maybe 500 jurors are in the pool right now. Do you think you could be a juror in this case?
It would be hard, but I believe I could because of my passion for righteousness and trying not to be biased. I think it would be hard, but I think I could be a juror, yes.
You know, Valerie, I'm wondering if down there in Sanford you're feeling like a smaller, tighter community as this trial opens, because those six jury members are going to be known by everybody. It's unclear if they're going to be sequestered, but, you know, they'll be interacting with members of the community all during this trial. That's going to be quite a hot seat.
That is a hot seat, but when they have the rules and you abide by rules, and that's why rules are set, then if they have agreed to be jurors, then I'm sure they know all of that goes along with being a juror. But, you know, after it's all over, they'll always have that part of their life as part of a significant role they had to play. And so we're just going to have to believe God and trust God that he'll give them the wisdom to be able to make the right decision.
Now, you're a pastor at Allen Chapel Church in Sanford, Florida, and, you know, this trial could take a while, depending on how the judge runs things. There isn't an enormous amount of testimony and evidence because so many people know what happened that night, and we've seen so much in the media coverage. But have you thought ahead to the weekend when there will be deliberations, if the jury is taking its time and you'll have to stand up in front of your parishioners in church and advise them on how to react depending on what the verdict is? Have you sketched out a sermon yet, Valerie?
I have not sketched out a sermon, but throughout the beginning of the trial, which for me started yesterday with the juror selection, I've encouraged my parishioners to accept the verdict. I've encouraged them not to participate in any protests or any riots. I've encouraged them to keep this as we have always had it at the Allen Chapel AME Church family as a peaceful movement in spite of, do a lot of praying, and I will continue to inform them as I sit in the courtroom from week to week. We have to live in this city after all of this is over, and so we're just prayerful, especially for the families and the whole process.
So, Reverend Houston, it's going to be one hand on the Bible this week and one hand on the law books, huh?
I guess that's correct. That is true.
Valerie Houston is pastor at Allen Chapel Church in Sanford, Florida. Reverend Houston, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, who is national security whistleblower Edward Snowden? The culture of electronic espionage and the politics of whistleblowers coming up. Snowden says he's defending democracy. Some of you agree.
My name is Gregory. I'm calling from Staten Island. I must state the fundamental rock-bottom liberal principle that in a democracy, government surveillance of citizens is outrageous. It violates the expectation we have of privacy. It leads to fascism.
Hero or traitor? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You might say we've got two data points now, two potential defendants in the world of electronic espionage and the leaking of classified information. One, of course, is a defendant, Private Bradley Manning in the WikiLeaks case. He's on trial in a military court. But now leaker Edward Snowden on the lam in Hong Kong, former CIA computer technician behind the latest national security leaks that have dominated the headlines since last week. Snowden, a low-level technician for the private security firm Booz Allen Hamilton. Low-level techie with a high level of access.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing.
It's Edward Snowden speaking to the Guardian news organization. The Guardian broke the latest surveillance story last week. We turn now to Tim Weiner, author of Enemies, A History of the FBI and Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Tim, welcome.
How are you?
You know, listening to Snowden talk, he sounds like so many well-educated but kind of libertarian-oriented techies that I've interviewed in Silicon Valley and in industries outside of government and espionage. How would you ever be able to rely on such an individual in a case of sensitive electronic surveillance?
Well, what's extraordinary is that we have now an enormous intelligence industrial complex. President Eisenhower warned us more than 50 years ago about the military-industrial complex, and he warned against, I'm quoting, the disastrous rise of misplaced power. The intelligence-industrial complex is a post-9/11 phenomenon, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who have top-level security clearances who are working both in the intelligence community and as contractors.
And this is proliferated because you can't run these giant systems without all these people with access, top secret access.
Well, it's proliferated because President Bush, after 9/11, ordered the intelligence services to grow by 50%. And they couldn't do that overnight. Patriotism for profit became a $50 billion a year business. Corporate clones of the CIA and the National Security Agency started sprouting all over the suburbs of Washington. And what's happened, and what is the case with Snowden, is that if you worked at NSA or CIA, the agencies began contracting out thousands and thousands of jobs. So one day you're an NSA employee or a CIA employee, you turn in your government ID, you go to work for two times the money at Booz Allen Hamilton, as Snowden did, or Lockheed Martin. And who do you work for? Are you working for the government? Are you working for profit? They just hire these people and stack them like cordwood in the corridors. And one of them, out of the hundreds of thousands, is going to have Snowden-esque ideas about getting under the hood of the machine of history and tinkering with the works.
You know, it's interesting. The Guardian published an op-ed piece from Daniel Ellsberg, the famous leaker in the Pentagon Papers case. He used to work for the RAND Corporation, a subcontractor consulting firm that still, of course, exists. Ellsberg was something of an outlier within the RAND culture. Do you think Snowden is a kind of Ellsberg character? And Ellsberg, of course, very supportive of Edward Snowden in his piece. What do you think of the Snowden character as typical or maybe unique within this culture of espionage?
I think, without wanting to do armchair psychoanalysis of the man, people who are idealistic, maybe a little innocent, are struck by the power of the intelligence services, and it triggers something within them. To the NSA, to the intelligence community, Snowden is a traitor. He's a spy, and he will be handled that way.
Ellsberg called the United States like Stasi, the Stasi organization in Eastern Europe, in East Germany, during the Cold War. Do you think that's a fair characterization? He very much supports Snowden. In your view, is this like the Pentagon Papers leak? Is it the most important thing to have happened in 20 years, as Ellsberg suggests?
No, I do not. I mean, what we have here essentially is a PowerPoint presentation of a computer system. What's extraordinary to me, and I think what made a lot of people really sit up straight when they saw this information, is the links between the spy services, like the National Security Agency, and the social media giants, like Google, like Facebook, and the disingenuous denials by Google and Facebook, like, oh, there's no back door here, there's no trap door. No, there's a front door, and they let the government in.
But there's something about the nature of all this electronic data that it's all being looked at by somebody. In the end,
don't assume that the spy services are able to look at the terabytes and gigabytes that they're storing for a rainy day.
So you think it matters hugely if the government is looking at it versus some techie over at Facebook is looking at it?
No. What is extraordinary, I think, about the information released here, and what should be, the president says he welcomes this, a matter of public debate, is there such a thing as privacy anymore, or have we surrendered it? Does the government, in pursuit of counterterrorism, get to read your mail without a warrant, listen to your phone calls without a warrant? What has happened, as happened with nuclear weapons policy and war strategy that Ellsberg, you know, released in the Pentagon Papers, is that technology is so far outstripping policy. We have, as a nation, our spy services have, the ability to harvest this information. Do they have the ability to analyze it? Do we as a people want them to do that?
But finally, it's possible that technology renders all the metaphors in which we think about this sort of thing moot. I mean, reading mail involves opening up an envelope, intercepting an object, and taking a look at it. In the digital domain, those kinds of metaphors don't apply. I'm just wondering if we're even prepared to have that debate right now.
We have to have that debate because we have a Constitution that includes the Fourth Amendment and its guarantees against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, the kind of general warrant that this technology provides is not like a search warrant where you have to show probable cause. A general warrant was one of the causes of the American Revolution against the British. The power of the king to search your home, to search your mail, to search in your desk drawers. And this is what the technology now poses. Yes, your home is your castle, but is a castle safe against the king?
That's the question. Tim Weiner, author of Enemies, A History of the FBI, and Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Tim, thanks so much.
Bet, John.
We're hearing a lot of outrage from you about all this. Is Edward Snowden a traitor or a hero?
This is Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. People like Snowden and Manning will be remembered 100 years from now. They'll be remembered as heroes. They'll be remembered as patriots.
That's certainly how John from Williston, North Dakota is going to remember Edward Snowden.
I just want to say I think this guy is a hero for letting this stuff out, but I think the bigger picture is this is part of a law that was pushed through right after 9/11, and nobody really wanted to look at it.
Good point. Is Snowden a hero or a traitor? And what do you think about civic engagement as an element here? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in the Twin Cities, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.